service on this Thursday, July 26th. Sunny and pleasant. Today's high, 78. This morning, humidity 85%, wind from the west at 9, 67 degrees in Racine, 70 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I can't remember being more excited to have in the studios with me Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. Professor Mast joins us on a quite frequent basis, and it just feels like the timing is supremely right, in that there are just so many things to be talking about in terms of kind of just the whole political realm right now and all kinds of important events overtaking the Trump administration. And of course, on the horizon, midterm elections, which are exceedingly important in this particular instance. And it's really interesting to anticipate what might happen in those midterm elections and what sort of forces at play might have a very, very powerful influence on how the midterms go. So we have a ton of things to talk about. And Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. I guess I'd say I pretty much agree with your preamble, but it's a little bit unusual to be excited to talk about this stuff in the middle of summer. Normally, you know, Our thoughts are turning to baseball and barbecues, and it's the fall, right, when we become excited to talk about politics. But this year seems somewhat exceptional in a variety of ways.
No kidding. Of course, these are exceptional times in all kinds of different ways. Real briefly, right off the bat, I just want to kind of get your thoughts on how you approach some of these questions that we are going to explore when you are wearing your professional hat as a professor of political science versus just Jerry Mast, a guy interested in America, interested in politics. Right. And what kinds of things do you think about in terms of trying to approach some of these really fiercely controversial and divisive questions in a way that is, in a sense, thoughtful and fair and even-handed without being mamby-pamby and shying away from the heart of the issue?
Well, when I'm looking at some of these events as a political scientist, I'm trying to bring to bear in my assessment of what's going on some history, right? What has happened in the past? What is it that the discipline of political science believes that it knows about the way institutions operate, the way these processes unfold, and so forth? I bring to it an awareness of some of the different political philosophies associated with a more kind of modern liberal perspective or a conservative perspective, and try to understand the different kind of conflicting perspectives that people are going to have about these events, given those different philosophies. As a scholar of public policy, that's where my PhD is in public policy, and I'm interested in the consequences of certain kinds of actions and inactions, the benefits, the costs associated with certain kinds of political events or government policies. And so I also come to it as a political scientist. I think political scientists, this is true of political science scientists in general, with an awareness of the complexity of these events. And so I hesitate to believe that I know for sure certain things are going to happen, because I do understand that they're complex, and the various meanings of these events, it's going to vary from observer to observer. And so I guess if I could say there's one kind of quintessential characteristic that political science brings to trying to understand these kinds of things, it is a kind of a sense of caution, right? Mm. A cautiousness that what it is that we're trying to make sense of is probably more complicated than we're aware of, even when we know that it's complicated. As a citizen, right, I guess I have my own preferences and biases kind of desires for what should happen. And I guess, in a way, it's hard to kind of completely separate those two lenses, so long as an observer is aware of what his or her biases are and the weaknesses associated with those, so long as an observer is aware of the advantages or virtues of different kinds of philosophical perspectives, then I think that one can try to make sense of politics in a way that's, I don't know how to put it, the least dangerous way possible.
right. And of course, I should think these are really interesting times for someone in your line of work, given that President Trump seems to be rewriting so many of the rules in terms of how one governs,
right,
how one functions as president, how one communicates as president,
absolutely,
how one frames issues or talks about one's opponents. He's just thrown out the book and is really doing this his own way, which of course is I should think endlessly fascinating fodder for anybody who studies political science. Plus he is someone who's made a lot of things happen. I mean, this has been an eventful presidency, and so there have been a whole lot of things for you to examine.
Right. So it's interesting, just as a matter of political science, because this is unusual, it's a different way of approaching things. I think it's also interesting, but also extraordinarily important from just a civic perspective, especially with respect to communication. I hope at some point in our conversation we can talk about, from just a kind of a civic perspective, this idea of truth, what is true and what is not. Pretty interesting interview on the PBS NewsHour in this past week. Judy Woodruff was interviewing a couple of guests, one of whom was the political commentator Peter Wehner. Peter Wehner is a policy advisor to George W. Bush and to the father, George Herbert Walker Bush, was also a member of the Reagan administration. He's a longtime Republican figure, as well as a kind of a political analyst. And Peter Wehner, they were talking about truth and the Trump administration. And Peter Wehner characterized the administration as one kind of dedicated to, and I'm quoting directly here, he said that Trump seems to be seeking to annihilate truth, to destroy the categories of truth and falsity. And this has really potentially dangerous and damaging impact on the kind of the civic culture. It's a kind of a poisoning of the civic culture, where we are unable to communicate with each other because we're talking about fundamentally different things, even though the words may be, referring to the same event. We perceive things in such really different ways. If there's no kind of common commitment to the idea of facts, then our capacity to relate in productive and democratic fashion, small d democratic fashion, is really kind of compromised.
Right. It's almost like we're existing not even on two different continents separated by an ocean or two different planets. It's almost like we're existing in two different dimensions.
Yeah, two different realities, even though, you know, to the extent that we can know anything, there is one reality empirically, right? There is this one. I mean, we can get into the quantum physics of it all, and then it becomes a little hazy. But so far as we know, right, the kind of the macro physical world, there's one world. And our perceptions of it are becoming so different that our ability to relate with one another on a political level is really, really damaged.
Well, we have a long list of things in terms of specifics to try to explore in terms of some of the big events with President Trump, and some of them are pretty closely related. For instance, it's hard to talk about what happened in Helsinki between President Trump and Mr. Putin without also talking about what happened just before that in terms of President Trump meeting with NATO leaders and some of what he said, or the interview with The Sun. In what he said about Prime Minister Theresa May and so on, that in a sense the contrast between those two events was very telling and is part of what probably stirred up some of the controversy in Helsinki. What's your sort of bottom line reaction to that whole chapter of the Trump presidency?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really does illustrate how little President Trump cares about elite opinion within the establishment of both parties, right? I mean, he's flaunting the establishment perspective clearly on the Democratic side and even the grassroots opinion on the Democratic side. But he's indifferent to kind of the Republican establishment perspectives when it comes to relationships with our historical allies and with an adversary like Russia. And so if you go around Capitol Hill talking to Republican members of Congress, it's not hard to find opinions from them in which they're alarmed and disturbed by the criticism that the president has levied, for instance, against Germany, kind of accusing them of being in the pocket of Russia, for instance, or with respect to his comments about the Prime Minister May, or with respect to his use of tariffs to try to extract concessions from countries with whom we've had good relationships, like Canada and Australia and Mexico. So there is this level of alarm at the kind of elite establishment level in the Republican ranks, with some exceptions. I mean, we can find allies of the president in these regards on Capitol Hill as well. You just can't find any on the Democratic side. So I think all of what has unfolded in this past few weeks really does kind of reinforce this idea that President Trump is in the midst of trying to remake the party and remake American politics in a kind of a more populist direction that really kind of rejects a lot of elite viewpoints and perspectives.
I noticed that one thing you wrote about some of what President Trump said about our NATO allies, and then very specifically about Britain and Prime Minister Theresa May as they grapple with the consequences of Brexit and so on. You wrote that it is a case of our president undercutting our most important allies at their most vulnerable moments.
Yeah, so that refers to the interview with the Sun, the London paper, owned by Mr. Murdoch, incidentally, in which President Trump was asked questions about Brexit. Right, Brexit is the United Kingdom's decision to remove itself from the European Union, and by moving out of the European Union, that triggers all kinds of important questions. Right, you think about all the relationships between the United Kingdom and Europe, as far as travel for their citizens, as far as business activities that take place, financing and so forth. There's loads and loads of relationships that cross those borders that now have to kind of be redefined a little bit. They have to kind of figure out, well, exactly what does this mean, that the UK is no longer committed to the European Union, and it's complex. And so the negotiations that Prime Minister May's government has been engaged in with the European Union have been difficult, right? And it's going to involve a lot of compromises in terms of just how far will the UK go in terms of its relationships with Europe. And the deal that Prime Minister May's government seems to have come up with raised real kinds of concerns within her own cabinet, right? And so the minister who is responsible for those negotiations decided to step down. This got more attention. Boris Johnson, the Home Secretary, former mayor of London, populist, kind of conservative populist in the UK, stepped down, critical of the deal that Ms. May's government negotiated for kind of giving too much concessions to the European Union, I think is a fair way to kind of sum it up.
As far as they were concerned.
Right, from their perspective. And so Ms. May is in a difficult kind of situation, right? She's got all of the people in the UK who don't want Brexit to happen, and that's a significant share of the country. And she has the people who want Brexit to happen, but it's not clear how it should happen. So she's in a difficult kind of situation. There's no real kind of clear, politically safe way for her to proceed in that regard. And into that environment steps President Trump, who in his conversation with The Sun criticized the deal, right, saying Ms. May has gone the wrong direction. He suggested some other path, easy for him to say, right?
Right.
Because he would personally suffer none of the consequences, at least directly, in terms of a bad deal that emerges. And then he turned and proceeded to praise Boris Johnson, right, who has kind of positioned himself as a rival within the Conservative Party of Ms. May. And so you're a guest in another country, the leader of which is in the middle of an enormously complicated and controversial policy process, and he offers this criticism of her and praise for her new, surprising rival. And of course, there's all kinds of controversy that stems from this, especially in the UK, a lot of eyebrows raised. And this is the kind of comment that presidents of either party historically would never have done, right? So, I mean, you have to know a little bit about the complicated nature of the policy in general and the complicated politics associated with it and steer clear of that, offering kind of bland, kind of non-committal comments
at most. I mean, understanding that you don't probably know enough about the intricacies of what
and
this
even if you do
doing.
And even if you do, right, you really don't want to put your finger on the scale of another country's politics openly like that. I mean, maybe covertly you
right.
might want to try to do it, but you don't want to do it openly, because this creates all kinds of political controversy and so forth. And I guess what I find really kind of interesting about this episode is that in the comments that emerged from President Trump the next day, in which he kind of backtracked on that, tried to deny some of the things that he had said, tried to claim other kinds of things that he said that didn't show up in the transcript that The Sun released, he seemed surprised at the blowback that he got for it. It just seems striking to me that one could be surprised in that kind of situation. And so I guess it's not clear to me that when I said a few moments ago that he's trying to remake the party, the Republican Party, he's trying to remake American politics, it's not clear to me that he has this really kind of clear plan in mind. It almost seems to me that he's acting more extemporaneously, more on the basis of instinct, rather than some kind of grand design.
Right. So, I mean, one way to do this, in the wake of all the criticism was to say, yep, I had a strong opinion. I decided I should say it, and I knew it was going to probably stir up a ruckus, but that's who I am, and that's how I do things, and so be it. But the fact, as you said, that he expressed real dismay and bewilderment that what he said and how he said it created this huge blowback of, right, of reaction, that suggests something else. I mean, inexperience maybe. That's
right. And he fell back on what has now become the common excuse for everything, that it's, oh, it's just fake news. You can't believe it. It's the press, right? But there's a transcript. It's hard for me to kind of make sense of what it is that he expects when he says, oh, that's fake news, knowing that there is a transcript, that the interview would have been recorded, that there's actual evidence that it was what it is, right? So it's confusing in that regard.
One of the interesting commentaries I read about this suggested that in a moment like this in the Trump presidency, and again, whether or not you agree with his sentiments on this particular point, or agree or disagree that he should have said what he said and so on. But this particular commentator said this is someone who, for nearly all of his adult life, because he has been so wealthy, he has also been, in many cases, insulated from the consequences of what he does and what he says.
Right.
And it's almost as though he is still living with those kind of expectations that you can kind of say and do whatever you feel like doing and saying in the moment, and the real world consequences somehow will not come back to haunt you.
Right. And as a, just as a businessman, as a television personality, right? I mean, being engaged in controversy is a way to generate buzz about you, right? Without having to worry so much about the outrageousness or the veracity of the things that you're saying. Whereas in the realm of politics, nuance is important, right? And while it's not a surprise, I'm sure, for your listeners to hear me say that politicians often play a bit loosely with the truth, to completely reject certain kinds of things that we know to be true, that is unusual, right? I mean, politicians are guilty, so to speak, of spinning things, interpretations of some event in a direction that goes maybe a little bit beyond plausibility, right? Because it's in their interest to push that interpretation. But to say something that is clearly and demonstrably not true,
right,
that doesn't happen very often, right?
Right?
Because that kind of thing kind of builds up as a track record and people just don't believe you.
Right. So to say, I never said that, when in fact you did and there's a
right.
clear record that you
right.
did, that's something we probably haven't maybe seen before, as opposed
right.
to you're taking it wrong or you're
right.
deliberately misunderstanding
Here's
what I
said. How you should interpret this.
Right, right.
And you know, you can disagree with the interpretation, but you can see how they get there, right? I mean,
right.
you have to assume certain kind of things along the way that, you know, maybe it's hard to assume, but you could, and if you do, then you could accept that conclusion. But to go from a situation in which, you know, you are on the one hand saying, you know, I accept President Putin's claim that Russia had no involvement in the 2016 election, and then 24 hours later say, that's not what I meant, right? Instead of should, I meant should not, right? And I do accept the intelligence agency's conclusion that Russia intervened. So there's this kind of 180-degree whiplashing that he's willing to engage in that just kind of leaves, I think, the country a bit bewildered about, you know, what is it that we're supposed to make of all of this?
Right. Well, it's bewildering some people. And, of course, there are plenty of other Americans who appreciate his style and appreciate, in a sense, the fearlessness slash recklessness with which he expresses himself and so on. I mean, this is speaking very powerfully to a certain sector of the population.
Right. So I mentioned the interview on the PBS NewsHour earlier in the week. They had put together a survey of the country. And that the survey was asking questions about the degree to which President Trump is truthful. And in that survey, the survey found that 58% of Americans believe that Trump tells the truth only some of the time or hardly ever. 3% think he never tells the truth. Add all those up, that's 61% that don't think he is an honest person. But 36% of Americans think he tells the truth almost all the time or most of the time. And when you break that down by party, of course, Republicans, a solid majority of them think he's being truthful most of the time or almost all the time.
Right. And I think part of that's probably the fact that, and we've talked about this before, that so much of his communication is of such an unguarded nature. I mean, the tweets that he sends out and other things that in which he is not speaking guardedly or cautiously, and it is that kind of freewheeling communicative style that appeals to people and seems, in some respects, very open and honest.
Right.
And, of course, what we're talking about is looking a little more closely and you know, trying to discern, is it really completely honest? Is it completely truthful?
Yeah, I've read some analysis that really does seem plausible to me in this regard. And the argument runs like this. It says that many of President Trump's supporters are willing to admit or accept that the president engages in some kind of minor lies along the way, but that he has in many ways kind of adopted this role of uncovering a truth that they feel has been denied about kind of the big picture. And because they see him as this speaker of truth about the big picture, the particulars don't much matter along the way.
Right. Interesting. What was your reaction to the events in Helsinki, that extraordinary press conference, which really stirred up an enormous wave of criticism from not just Democrats, but from plenty of Republicans as well, and from plenty of conservative commentators who really had a lot of trouble with, in a sense, the way President Trump presented himself and the way he seemed to frame Putin and his policies and so on.
Right. I mean, it really does kind of represent, I think, this gulf between the political establishment in the United States and President Trump. He really seems indifferent to how he's going to be perceived by people at the top. In that regard, it's hard to imagine a president, right, any other president, saying the things that he did in that news conference, in the Q&A after their meeting. It used to be the case, right, that Democrats and Republicans had plenty to disagree about and were willing to be very open and vocal about their disagreements, as it applies to domestic policy. But when it comes to foreign policy, they tended to kind of come together and be fairly united. Those days are gone for the most part. Foreign relations have become much more partisan than they used to be. American political scientist by the name of Aaron Wildowski, longtime professor at the University of California, came up with a thesis about the presidency. He said that we have essentially a kind of a dualistic presidency, the two presidencies. In both of these different arenas, presidents are quite powerful. But in the domestic arena, for domestic kinds of policies, the president is much more checkable. He can be challenged. And Americans expect the Congress, for domestic kinds of policies, to play a very prominent role with respect to what our policy should be, how our politics should proceed. And so because there is this expectation on the part of the public, and because the Constitution gives very clear authorities to Congress with respect to lawmaking, the president, while still a powerful player, can be thwarted in terms of the agenda that the president wants to pursue on domestic kinds of issues. But when it comes to foreign matters, Valdovsky argues, it's a different ballgame. The president has much more latitude to pursue what the president wants when it comes to national security, foreign relations and trade and so forth. And so the ability of the president constitutionally to be commander-in-chief, to be the primary negotiator of treaties and international agreements, gives the president much more sway in that regard. And historically, members of Congress have been fairly deferential to presidents on foreign relations. And presidents, for the most part, have kind of proceeded in directions of foreign policy that maintained a kind of path, a traditional path. And so, although, you know, you'd see differences from Democrat to Republican, Democrat to Republican with respect to foreign policy, the swings that you would get from administration to administration on foreign relations, much narrower than the swings you might see on domestic matters. And now, because President Trump has kind of thrown out this kind of commitment to kind of traditional ways of speaking, traditional ways of relating, has embraced particular kinds of tools like tariffs, right, that his own party establishment had clearly kind of rejected in the last quarter century or so. He is kind of put himself out there in this kind of new space. And both party establishments have been willing to criticize him in a way that, I mean, it's just new and unusual to me. I have never seen, nor have I read about, you know, presidencies that predate me. An example where a president is so uniquely opposed by the establishment on certain kinds of questions. Another example of this that I've written about academically is the issue of climate change, in which the president has is in the process of removing the United States from the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement is this kind of international commitment to lower greenhouse gas emissions to stave off harmful climate change in the future. And at this juncture, every country in the world is now signed off on the Paris Agreement. For a while, Nicaragua and Syria were holdouts, but they have joined. And now the United States will be, assuming this goes through, the only country in the world to not agree to this. In the days and weeks that followed the president's big Rose Garden announcement of our withdrawal, all kinds of mayors stepped up and said, the people of my city will commit to meeting our share of the target reductions, right? And governors committed to remaining faithful to this agreement. The United Nations in New York held meetings in the weeks afterwards in which mayors and governors were approaching the delegations from foreign countries to kind of reaffirm their commitments to this. It's kind of like foreign policy being conducted at the bottom of the federal level in a way that's really historically – I can't think of some kind of historical analog. Foreign policy is definitely at the national level, right, constitutionally, and the president is the one who drives it. So now we kind of see foreign relations being carried out by city and state-level governments. So this idea of the two presidencies is kind of – it seems dated in a way. And when it comes to what does this mean for our politics, this is all kind of new territory.
For sure. Of course, one of the really intriguing questions is about what is the nature of the relationship between Trump and Putin and what is going on there. You raised a very interesting possibility that we don't have a lot of time to talk about, but you point to President Trump's craving for flattery, making him utterly manipulable. It is your suspicion that there might be at least an element of that at play in the relationship between these two world leaders.
Yeah, I mean, much has been made about the president's kind of self-centeredness or narcissism, and he does seem to respond very well to flattery. And it's hard to understand exactly what the motivations of another person are, but in this case, he seems to be the kind of person whose buttons can be pushed. Might work out. Another foreign policy example where perhaps, you know, we've moved in an interesting direction that is potentially better. It's not clear that it will be at this point, but would be North Korea.
Right.
The president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, very flattering of President Trump. He, in turn, very flattering back. And where the two countries seem to be at some impasse, maybe we're moving in a direction in which that impasse might be solved, and maybe we can move into a more positive kind of relationship. It's not clear at this point that is so. The kind of the underlying realities of that issue haven't particularly changed. But at least on a kind of a rhetorical level, there does seem to be more interaction between the two executives than there were before. You could say that in some ways, I kind of view the relationship with Russia in a similar fashion. The two countries really should be on better terms with one another. Both are nuclear powers. Both have influence around the world in ways that it would be better for us to be closer to one another in terms of what it is that we're trying to achieve on the international stage. And yet, and so, you know, I guess we should be willing and open to a more positive relationship with Russia. But we also need to do so knowing that there are different interests between the two countries. And we should do so in a way that still allows us to hold accountable Russia for actions that, to the best of our knowledge, the intelligence community suggest Russia has engaged in to our detriment. And I think interfering with one's elections is definitely something that qualifies. Mm-hmm.
There was a very interesting editorial just in, I think, today's Chicago Tribune by Jonah Goldberg, in which he was trying to make sense of what he felt like were just, in to his mind, were just bewildering poll numbers regarding Helsinki. And the fact that, according to an ABC News Washington Post poll, 66% of Republicans said they supported President Trump's, let's call it, performance in right. Helsinki right. in terms of with Russia and Putin. And what Jonah Goldberg suggests in this editorial that I would love to just get your thoughts for is that he thinks that sometimes in poll numbers like this, something else is actually being expressed rather than, yes, I'm glad that President Trump did what he did in Helsinki, right, or right, I like right, what right, he said, or, right. Or so on. He writes, I suspect that in that question, many hear, do you still support Trump? Or do you think the media is blowing this out of proportion? And so when they are answering that poll question and saying yes, they're not perhaps all of them saying I support what he did in Helsinki. It's just another way for them to say I support this president. I want us to give him a chance. I thought that was really intriguing.
Right. I completely agree with that. It's hard for us to know for sure the motivations for individuals when they answer a particular question in a survey. I think it is safe to assume that there are multiple motivations, right? And so that some of those expressed positions do in fact represent an explicit belief in whatever it is that's being expressed. But there's probably also strategic kinds of motivations in which people agree with a particular kind of thing, not because they agree with that thing in particular, but because in general they want to send this message of support for something larger that specific thing is a part of. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's probably true. And again, it kind of just seems to me to indicate that there is this kind of interesting contest in the Republican Party right now, a contest over what is the nature of the Republican Party, what is the direction it's going to head in the future, what are the particular kinds of values it wants to espouse. Former Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, recently said, there is no Republican Party, it's the party of Trump right now, that the real Republican Party is kind of off taking a nap somewhere. And I don't know that I completely agree with that. I think that you can still hear voices on the Republican side who are concerned about some of the things that the president has done. And I kind of expect a much more open kind of conflict within the Republican Party in the coming years over its direction. So you have people like Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, I think, is somebody to keep your eye on as a kind of a spokesperson for conservatism and the Republican Party that is going to – it's pretty easy to draw clear distinctions between, you know, Senator Sasse's vision for their party and President Trump's. Another person perhaps to keep an eye on would be Republican governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, another kind of outspoken but nonetheless kind of conservative who is willing to draw real kinds of distinctions in terms of governing style, policy substance, and so forth. And those kinds of voices, I mean, Jeff Flake from Arizona is stepping down. Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee, stepping down. They're not going to be running for office, but I expect that they'll remain in the kind of the public eye, the public stage, kind of advocating for a direction for the Republican Party that is different from the one that President Trump seems to be pushing. And so this issue of Russia and President Trump's relationship with Putin, although I think it's definitely it is definitely the case that Republicans, a solid majority of them, support the president in that regard, it's not clear to me, because of Mr. Goldberg's suspicions, it's not clear to me that level of support is real on the substance of what is being asked. And I suspect that, especially if the midterms go against the Republican Party this fall, and as we get closer to the 2020, I think that we'll see kind of a rising, more explicit and open kind of debate and conflict within the Republican Party moving forward.
A couple other things more on the domestic front for us to talk about. One of them, of course, is all of the trouble along the Mexican border with undocumented immigrants and so on, and separation of families. It turned into a PR nightmare, for the Trump administration, scrambling for damage control. Of course, what has your sense been of how they have handled this politically explosive problem?
I think that some of their instincts are really good, but I think they've made some really bad mistakes. The mistakes rhetorically, kind of the way in which immigrants have been characterized is excessive and offensive and so forth. I think on a more fundamental level, there are legitimate concerns about immigration, and I think that both parties have kind of failed to try to address this effectively. I think you can point to goodwill in both parties. President Obama tried to come up with reasonable solutions. Senator Rubio, a Republican of Florida, has in the past tried to do so. President Bush tried to come up with a compromise. But the politics of this has been so difficult that neither party has successfully kind of come up with a lasting kind of comprehensive immigration reform. And so I think that President Trump is not wrong to see this as an issue that needs to be addressed on some level. And I think that countries do, in fact, need to protect their borders and monitor and manage who comes in and who doesn't. Obviously, the child separation issue was a terrible move, both as a matter of kind of humanitarianism, but also as a matter of kind of political optics. It just is not the kind of thing in which the president is going to have many allies outside of those who are already kind of committed to him regardless.
Right. One thing you I saw you post that was quite an interesting article was about the whole matter of xenophobia and the fact that that when one is sort of touting policies that at least sort of touch on that matter of fear or distrust of foreigners, that that can play very, very well in certain local situations where you are touching very much on where people live kind of right in the trenches, right, that they might feel some of these effects very directly. But that on a national scale, that does not seem to play nearly as effectively. And I remember you saying that this is something, this is a reality from which you draw some comfort and encouragement.
Right. I think in terms of the kind of the national sentiment, I think the country does want, in fact, some kind of comprehensive control of the issue, some kind of response in which, you know, something along the lines that George W. Bush advocated or Marco Rubio advocated or Barack Obama advocated would, you know, for the most part, satisfy the country. But there are kind of key constituencies in which this is really not the case. And those key constituencies are distributed in just a kind, the right kind of way that allows for the president to kind of take advantage of that when it comes to when it came to the election in 2016, right, which it didn't work as far as the popular vote is concerned. But the constituencies are well located in certain kinds of swing states that it really helped him capture the Electoral College. And I think more generally, we do need to kind of ask ourselves some difficult questions about culture, about both the promise and the perils associated with diversity. You see this kind of unrest occurring not just in the United States, but throughout Western mm-hmm. countries, the United Kingdom. I think Brexit reflects itself a lot of kind of concern about diversity and foreigners. I think that the national front in France, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, Wilders Party in the Netherlands. I mean, there's a long list of kind of political movements in which people are worried about their culture. They want to kind of retain their cultural identity, and in and of itself, that strikes me as a fairly benign kind of sentiment to have, right? I mean, I think we can take pride in who we are as a people, certain kinds of cultural things that we share that bind us together. And I think that it's not uncommon, nor I think even unreasonable for people to worry, right, that certain kinds of traditions can get lost if we become extraordinarily diverse. So, I mean, there's legitimate issues that reside in those kinds of what we might call xenophobic political movements that really we need to pay attention to, even though xenophobia can manifest itself into very kinds of dangerous kinds of politics in which racism and prejudice and discrimination against people can be the unfortunate result.
Right. And of course, I think what you're suggesting is that people that have some real trouble with, let's say, xenophobia need to be careful not to react, in a sense, with a blowtorch to some very legitimate questions that deserve to be thoughtfully discussed. And, you know, I mean, we can't be accusing everybody who wants to retain their cultural identity of being, you know, one step away from the Ku Klux Klan. I mean,
right.
We need to
right.
be more nuanced about this.
No, of course not. I mean, I think it's healthy that a city like Milwaukee has Irish Fest and German Fest and Bastille Days, right? I mean, I think that as a country of immigrants, we are particularly aware of the value of kind of knowing where you came from and retaining at least some kinds of connections to that past. But as a nation of immigrants, it also is incumbent on us to kind of respect other people's traditions and to recognize that both countries and cultures are not static but are inherently dynamic and open to change. And so the question really, I think, we as a people need to kind of confront in an intelligent fashion is what kinds of change are we comfortable with and pay attention to our principles, our political principles, mm-hmm. In trying to come up with answers to that question.
Is that all? That's all we have to do.
That's all we got to do. Yes, and that requires a healthy civic community, right? And so we have our work cut out for us, trying to recognize that, you know, we're in this together.
Absolutely. Well said. Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. I knew this would be a great conversation, and indeed I think we touched on a whole lot of really, really important issues and questions. I really do appreciate you being